Imagine a justice system built on rigorous evidence, not gut instincts or educated guesses about what works and what doesn't. More people could access the civil justice they deserve. The criminal justice system could be smaller, more effective, and more humane. The Access to Justice Lab here at Harvard Law School is producing that needed evidence, and this podcast is about the challenge of transforming law into an evidence-based field. I'm your host, Jim Greiner, and this is Proof Over Precedent.
So, Alicia Fishbane, welcome to Proof Over Precedent. Thank you so much for being with us. Really appreciate it. Looking forward to the conversation today about various interventions and studies about those interventions to reduce failure to appear rates in criminal or in quasi-criminal proceedings. So, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here. We're huge fans of your work.
Terrific. So when we start with a little introduction of you, who are you and how did you come to be involved with Ideas 42?
Yes, I'm a managing director at Ideas 42, and I also currently lead our unwarranted initiative, which prevents missed court dates and their resulting warrants in jail across the U.S. I've spent my career at the intersection of behavioral science and evidence, designing, testing, scaling interventions in a number of countries and on issues from education to health, financial well-being, and most recently, the justice space. And so the theme across all of this work is that through a better understanding of human behavior, we can make systems and programs work more effectively, and that seemingly small changes like reminding people about their court date or giving them clearer forms can have really profound impacts on people's lives.
Terrific. And so for folks who are new to this idea or have not heard the idea of behavioral science before or behavioral economics, what kind of educational background does one get if one's interested in pursuing this field? Is it psychology? Is it economics? Is it public policy? Is it government? Or could it be any of those?
It could be any of those. More and more, we're seeing programs that provide behavioral science, either degrees or certainly more classes. When I started out in undergrad, it wasn't available. I was actually searching for something like this. Fast forward to when I went to grad school, I studied public policy, and it was there that I found behavioral economics, and it opened the door to these incredible academics who were applying it to solve real-world problems, founding the amazing organizations I've been fortunate to be a part of for the past 20 years.
Terrific. And so where did you end up going to school and what was your major or what field of study did you study within public policy?
I was at the Harvard Kennedy School, and I actually went there with the idea of studying health. I had been working in reproductive health globally a little bit before that. And when I arrived, I found behavioral economics. It was something that I had been looking for a long time. I knew in college, I had learned about how, for example, mass marketing and the media could influence behavior in ways that was harmful to people. And I was really inspired to find a profession that would do the exact opposite. So how could I help to influence behavior for the good of humanity?
Terrific. And tell us one fun fact about yourself.
Well, I sometimes say my first advanced degree was 8 months of backpacking outside the U.S. It was mostly in Asia. After a few years of working and saving, this was in the early internet cafe days, pre-cell phone. And travel teaches you a lot. But I think backpacking in particular offers something very unique. You wake up each day free to stay where you are or explore somewhere completely new. And you're living fully in the moment in a really unique way, which brings an incredible sense of presence.
And some people tell me this is not something I've ever been able to quite wrap my brain around, but some people tell me that doing that is actually fun. It's, again, not an emotion I've ever been able to to associate with myself, but did you find it so?
Oh, it was great. It was such a formative time, and maybe one day I'll have a chance to do it again.
I don't know whether to say I hope so for you, but anyway, well, I hope whatever the right outcome is, it happens. So let's talk about failure to appear. And am I correct that? Well, actually, let me just ask. We're going to talk about failure to appear in criminal cases. That's right. Is that correct? That these studies were all about criminal defendants?
Most of them are our study that we did in New York and Sacramento are our study in Tulare is with people who got traffic tickets.
You got traffic. And I should say, these studies you work now, I should have asked first. You work for Ideas 42, and these studies were all done within your scope as an Idea 42 researcher. Tell me first, what is Ideas 42?
Ideas 42 is a global nonprofit, and we use behavioral science for social good. So we're using all the scientific knowledge we have to date, insights from the context where we're working, and we're designing solutions that make systems and programs more effective, with the goal for us of helping people lead lives that are healthier, more prosperous, more secure. And what this looks like ranges from helping first-generation students in the U.S. stay in college and graduate to helping improve birth outcomes in developing countries, for example. In the justice space, we're really focused on court appearance right now. We're going to be talking about some of the studies in court appearance today that we've done, and other researchers have done some work as well. We've shown that improving communications about your court date can have a significant impact on appearance, and it's super cost effective. So, day to day, what that looks like for our work these days at Warranted is we make court date notices clearer and easier to act on. We help set up effective reminder programs. And all of this, I should say, is within the system. So it's set up to endure over time, which means we're directly supporting courts and other legal agencies, as well as state-based advocates and policymakers.
So let's talk about failure to appear. So if you, it, many people think if you miss a court date and something, for something like a low-level criminal offense, maybe you're picked up for smoking a joint or something like that, that you, it's not a big deal. It's kind of like missing a coffee with a friend. You give the friend a call and you say, "I'm so sorry, something came up, and could we reschedule?" Is that the way it is with courts? Are they like your friends meeting for coffee?
Not exactly. It's not like that, and it's also not like missing a doctor's appointment or something similar. In fact, we see people miss doctor's appointments and court dates at about the same rates, yet the stakes are far higher when we're talking about missing a court date. It's quite common, and it's impacting millions of Americans every year. And it's really, the rates of missing court is driven by these lower level cases, charges like open containers, traffic violations, and it's really harmful to both the system and the people who are missing the court date. So from a systems perspective, missed court dates create a whole cascade of problems. Cases are slowed, dockets have to be rescheduled, bench warrants are issued, meaning that people are arrested and jailed, and that police and sheriffs are dealing with this rather than public safety issues. And on the people side, it causes consequences that are quite severe and immediate. We're talking about criminal cases. It's typically a bench warrant that's issued. And warrants on their own can be really quite harmful, keeping people from a job, housing, or a license, or accessing social services. But they also certainly lead to, they can lead to arrest, jail time, and additional fees. And I think what's particularly troubling is that we see now in some jurisdictions, more people are in jail for missing court than any other reason. So the issue of missed court dates really is a hidden crisis in our country, and it's something we're all paying the cost on. It's the government, people, employers, and taxpayers alike.
Consequences to the individual, consequences to the system. It seems like then that courts would have been innovating potentially for decades to try to reduce failure to appear rates. Have courts, in fact, been, to your knowledge, innovating for decades to try to reduce failure to appear rates?
I think one of the challenges is a misunderstanding and really what is driving misappearance. And it's very hard to solve a problem if we don't have the real reasons why the problem exists in the first place. And so, as we talked about in the past, the standard response has been to punish people for missing court as a way to encourage them to attend. And unfortunately, despite their best intention, many people aren't showing up to court. The good news is we have these new studies which are showing that we have alternatives, and courts are beginning to adopt these solutions.
So what are some of the reasons why people miss court dates, and how do we know that those are in fact the reasons?
Yes, missing court is something that, like we've talked about, missing a coffee date or missing a doctor's appointment happens to everyone at times. And the reasons why they miss are really relatable. We've done research on this. Others have done research on this. There's both qualitative and quantitative data on this. And the primary reason people miss is forgetting the date, being unaware of it, or receiving information that's confusing or unclear. We also see there's logistical barriers like work conflict, transportation issues. And finally, we also see there's anxiety or fear about the court process. So some people may not understand what will happen. They may feel intimidated, or they just simply worry that they'll end up in jail.
Got it. And so there are at least many people, a substantial portion of the population, who simply don't follow the traditional court narrative that if you miss a court date, you did it on purpose, you're trying to evade judicial process, you may be trying to abscond from the jurisdiction entirely. First of all, let me just clarify, is that accurate that there are at least a substantial number of people for which that narrative is simply not the case?
The data shows that narrative is a myth, and that most people are trying to go, they intend to go, they want to comply, and some go to great lengths to try and do so.
And you mentioned in part then some of these folks will respond to interventions such as clearer communication. I just want to share one anecdote with you before we talk about the excellent work that Ideas 42 and you in particular have done on this area. When we did a study, the Access to Justice Lab did a study several years ago. We've never submitted it for publication for various reasons, to try to encourage debt collection defendants to appear in court. We didn't put this in the paper at the time, but I think it's far enough away in time from when it happened now to be able to share that the summons form that the debt collection defendants received, telling them that they must appear at the courthouse, or they would lose their case. In other words, the court would summarily rule against them in the debt collection case, did not include the court's address, its physical address, where it demanded that they come under pain of losing the case. And we had a quiet word with the court about that, as opposed to taking it to the newspapers, which was my first instinct. But it suggests that if that can happen, which I'm sure nobody in the court intended, I'm sure it was just a large oversight. If that can happen, then there might be some communications issues that could be solved, because I always thought there might have been an irony in the word summons when you're not telling people to where they are being summoned. So I take it you're starting. Court communication documents, basically, tickets and summonses, but they didn't start out that in that kind of bad shape. Is that correct?
They have their challenges. I don't think we've seen one to date that has missed an address entirely, though.
Terrific. So tell me then, what was the state of affairs there were three studies that you mentioned. Pick any one of them. What was the state of affairs with the court documents before you started? What did they generally look like?
Sure. And I think this is really a theme across many court documents. For example, if we're talking about our work in New York City, it was the summons form, which is essentially a ticket given to people who are being charged with mostly quality of life offenses, like open container or being in a park after dark. And the ticket itself, when you look at it, it's just a lot of administrative data and boxes and fields that law enforcement fills in and provides to the court. And at the very bottom, if you can find it, is the court date.
Got it. Are there other things that, and actually we will include these links in the Proof Over Precedent podcast posting on the Access to Justice websites, but the various publications that y'all pursued, one in Science and then some postings on Ideas 42's website, include photographs of the before and after traffic ticket. For example, in New York, the Science article, I have to give a shout out to Orly Oos, who is, just because I think it's so funny, given how much she surpassed me as a researcher, but she's a former student of mine back in her grad school days. Just, I think, it's showing how old I am. But anyway, this is a publication that you did with Orly Oos. And is it Anuj Shah? Did I pronounce that correctly?
With Anuj Shah and also colleagues of ours at both Ideas 42 and the University of Chicago Crime Lab. So it was a team effort. Yes. And as you said, you can see it online. And, you know, what one of the things that we did that we see commonly in many tickets and legal forms generally is that, first of all, a lot of them have a lot of legal language that people struggle to understand. That can be quite intimidating. And actually lead people away from taking action when you read the legal language if you don't understand it. Yet this summons form itself, the title of it originally was complaint/information, which doesn't suggest that there's a particular action that someone needs to take. And so amongst the many changes we made, one of the first ones we did was create the title to say criminal court appearance ticket so that people could receive it and understand exactly what it meant for them to do.
Terrific. Terrific. And so the idea then is to try to use the lessons that you learned in graduate school, the behavioralism ideas, clear communication concepts, did these to put into the document that individuals receive that tells them the court date. Where did these concepts, where they did they come? There are various fields they could have come from, and I'm curious, you know, how many of them were involved here. So when we design self-help materials at the Access to Justice Lab, we try to deploy adult communication theory. We try to employ some psychological theories like positive affect theory, or we try to employ some economics theory. So, for example, in the picture on the Science article, there is a suggestion of highlighting the consequences of missing court. So that's a straight up classical economics deterrence idea, deterrence in the sense of consequences. Here are the consequences, right? Don't suffer them. The sociologist would say all of you people are completely crazy. What you should be talking about is letting everybody know that everybody's doing this, that you won't be alone, that this will be something that you won't be alone in doing this. There'll be part of a group. There'll be people there to support you, et cetera. Which of these various things did you think about when you were designing the new tickets to try to encourage people to show up?
Our work really draws from all the behavioral sciences, which can include social psychology, behavioral economics, decision-making science, and really look to all the work that has been done prior. You reference consequences, and there was one study before we launched this. It was in Nebraska with postcards that showed that consequences were effective in helping people show up to court, and it worked better to include the consequences rather than not when this is a randomized trial and trying to determine which of the types of messages shared would be most effective. So that's one thing we included in the citation was the consequences, knowing that it was a powerful tool. And we also used the idea of, loss framing. What are people going to be losing if they don't show up to court, along with framing it in a way that can help empower them to take action. So the way we phrased it, for example, in our ticket is, to avoid a warrant for your arrest, you must show up to court. We also had a hypothesis, for example, that it would be helpful for people to understand that, you know, showing up doesn't mean they're going to be charged immediately or immediately assumed to be guilty. So we, right below that, inform them at court, you may plead guilty or not guilty.
Terrific. And then, so this is the one of the two interventions that you pursued in New York, was a redesign of the traffic ticket and the summons process, the summons document. And then there was a second intervention that you pursued in New York as well. What was that one?
That is reminders. And so first we tackled the actual ticket people get. So everyone receives that ticket. We want to make sure that everyone understands what their court date is. And, you know, as part of the design, I think one other thing I'll just mention is that, you know, we talked about how the court date was at the very bottom. We made sure that all pieces of information relevant to the recipient of this ticket were at the very top, so they wouldn't miss it. Now, fast forward, the court date listed on that ticket is typically 60 to 90 days later, leaving plenty of room to forget. And so we followed that up with text reminders for people.
And tell me how that worked. Does everyone who is arrested required to give a cell phone number under pains of further arrest, or because probably not everybody had or has currently a cell phone or something like that? How did it work?
We like to recommend that law enforcement or anyone else who is engaging with the recipient asks for the number, but it's not required for the person to give it. So in this case, phone numbers were new on the tickets. It took a while to increase the collection of phone numbers. It was a new step in the process. For everyone who provided a phone number on the ticket, we were then able to provide a reminder. Now, I should say, though, we first did a randomized trial so that we had a control group as well as different treatment arms where we tested different types of messaging. So in the very beginning, if you provided a phone number on the ticket, you were basically randomly assigned one of those groups, either no message or one of the different three potential message options that we were sending to people before court.
Terrific. And was that a sort of preliminary randomized trial that you saw to pick one of the messages, or was that actually the RCT? Are you referring to the RCT you ran in New York, the actual one you ran?
That's the RCT that we ran. And based on the results from that, New York then continued with the most effective message over time. And so we wanted to, because this was the first time, now certainly there have been more reminder studies to date, we were not aware at that point of any published randomized trial regarding text messages. So first we wanted to make sure, A, the text messages were working, and B, within the different types of messages that we created using behavioral science theory and things that have been proven in the past, what would be the ideal message sequence to be sending to people?
Let's talk about then the New York study. There were two interventions there. One is the ticket redesign, and then the second is the text messaging. Were those rolled out at the same time, or were they rolled out one first and then the other one?
The citation was rolled out first, and the reason is because we needed that phone number to be collected on the citation to be able to send reminders. So once those new citations were in process, we were able to then begin the RCT for the reminders.
And so was the RCT, I think you just clarified, the new summons form, the new citation form, it was not subject to an RCT. And so here at Proof Over Precedent, our question will be, why not? Why didn't you randomize that one?
We asked, and we learned that it was quite difficult to randomize across all the precincts in New York City in terms of rollout. And so what we did instead was we learned that an easy way for this to be rolled out would be to let each officer use up their bundle of tickets, their pad of summons forms, before they use up all the old ones before switching to the new ones. And that's fairly random. Everyone has a different number of tickets left and use them at different rates. And so we use what is called a regression discontinuity design. And by looking at all of these different officers across New York City and looking at the data in which they particularly switched over from using that old pad of forms to the new pad of forms, we were able to create an analysis that led us to understand what the impact of those forms were. Despite not being able to a randomized trial, we were able to do this regression discontinuity design.
And so for folks who have heard of these sorts of things before but may not be intimately familiar with them, this was another way of saying regression discontinuity in time is a before versus after study. Is that correct?
Yes.
And the key assumption of these studies of before versus after comparisons is that the world hasn't changed too much over time in a way that will affect the appearance rates or the outcome variable here, the appearance rates. Is that correct? Is that accurate?
Yes, it assumes that. So it becomes certainly more challenging as time spans increase and there are potential for more policy changes. What's nice is the officers were switching dates over several months. So we were able to capture also these changes over several months as they were using up their old pads and starting to use the new ones.
And so you were able to nail down the exact date that each officer switched over from old to new. And that was, as you say, not all the same date. And so the hope is that the staggering of the officer switchover would have alerted you had there been large changes over time that might have affected the appearance rates. Is that all fair?
Yes.
Terrific. Okay, super. And so this, by the way, for those of our listeners at Proof Over Precedent who hear some of my interviews, they will know that I'm extremely skeptical of anything other than an RCT out in the field. This is one of the regression discontinuity designs that I believe because of what we just discussed. Had there been one big moment of changeover where all officers changed over at the same time, I would have been quite nervous about it. Thinking that there might have been publicity efforts or, you know, maybe cops are being more friendly because now they're focused on this effort to try to reduce failure to appear. And the process of doing the study is educating the cops that, you know, failure to appear is a problem, not just for the individual, but for them as well, et cetera, et cetera. But the staggered adoption rate to me goes a long way towards allaying fears about the key assumption of regression discontinuities. And so we did that one. And what did you see? What did the staggered before versus after comparison show you? Did the redesign ticket work?
It worked. There was a non-appearance rate of 47% beforehand with the old ticket, and with the new one, we saw a non-appearance rate of 41%. So just over 6 percentage points or 13%.
Right. So for those who were confused by that, I was actually going to get you to unpackage that. There's a difference between percentage points and percent. So it's a 6 percentage point drop, which is what I typically try to report and emphasize. But you said that's a 13% effect. Where does that 13% come from?
That is the relative difference between the 47 and the 41%.
And then after you did the redesign ticket, then you implemented the text message reminder rate. Could you implement the text message reminders for everyone, or only for people, say, who gave you telephone numbers?
We could only do it for people who gave us telephone numbers, and for that group, we saw a. Not so, you know, this is on top of the citation. So we already have the effect of the citation. This is an additive effect on top of that. So the baseline for the group of folks who provided a phone number and were randomized into this reminder RCT had a baseline non-appearance rate of 38%. And then the most effective message sequence reduced it to 28% non-appearance rate. So 9.9 percentage points, or in this case, a relative decrease of 26%.
Got it. Okay. And so this is an important point for people like me. It may sound like a focusing on minutia, but of course that's what I do for a living. One of the concerns in this area and in others is that when you try various interventions to tackle the same problem, what you get are people who will respond to some intervention, any one of them. And so it looks like if you've got, say, three things that you can do to tackle a problem, and you pile all three together at once, you might get a 15% reduction because each one alone gave you 5%. And so 5 + 5 + 5 = 15. But what you don't realize is that actually there's just a set of people who will respond to any of your interventions, and you're only going to get 5% if you do all three together, because that's the people who will respond to any of the interventions. Here, that's not the case, right? And you could tell because you rolled them out sequentially. You could tell that you got a big, a 6 percentage point drop from the redesigned ticket, and then for the subset of people who had the cell phone number and gave it to you, who were a little less likely to miss the court date already, not hugely, but a little less likely, you got a further drop in their non-appearance rate from the text message reminder. Is that all accurate?
Yes, that's absolutely accurate. And what we saw when we did lab studies to just make sure that what we thought was working about the citation was actually what was happening, we saw that the citation was helping people identify the court date, location, all of that information, and retain it better. And then, of course, the reminders are really helping people in the moment remember and plan ahead for their court date during that week of the court date.
And so it is one thing to keep in mind for various court staff or for judges who are thinking about pursuing these various FTA reducing interventions, that the text message reminder here was for people who had experienced the better citation form. In other words, you didn't have a condition where we had the old citation form, the less communicative citation form, and then the text message reminder. Don't really know what that would have done. Probably would have reduced it, the failure to appear rate, but don't really know by how much, because the idea was, well, let's do the easy part first, just the form itself. It's not that text messages are particularly hard, but you'd think, you know, you control the form completely. You don't even need any new communication apparatus. You just need to redesign what the printer does, right? And then on top of that, you did the text messaging. Is that all accurate?
Yes. And we've seen in other studies that reminders on their own, even without changing any paperwork that people get, are effective. And we see that changing the paperwork is effective. And the paperwork is something that everyone is guaranteed to get. So, you know, one of the things we are really trying to promote is thinking about this process of attending court holistically, and how do we take advantage of every touch point available to be helping people show up? Because as you say, it is additive.
Yeah. Let's talk about those other studies. So in Sacramento and then in Tulare, did you which of these two interventions did you pursue? Were those the redesigned form or the text messaging or both?
In Sacramento, we were sending reminders for people who were charged with a misdemeanor. Although in Sacramento, it's a little bit of a different case. They were in the process of adopting a new technology system. And so there we rolled out mailed reminders. So we designed a letter and a corresponding envelope. And that's what we've been using while they're setting up their new system.
And the report, of course, will include the link, but the report on Ideas 42 report includes a photograph of the envelope. And this is interesting to me looking at it. So in the problem of default part one publication that the lab pursued several years ago, We tried to be as unofficial as possible. And even included our favorite cartoon figure in the return address, our cartoon figure we call Blob. And Blob's a whole different story. I'm hoping to interview the, I guess we call Blob's mother, the creator of Blob, the cartoonist, an artist that came up with Blob. We included Blob in the return address slot. This envelope, how would you describe it? The envelope for the Sacramento. It looks kind of official looking to me, but it also looks basic in terms of the communication. The communication is very clear. So how would what were you after when you were describing when you were creating this envelope?
Well, we were inspired by your work with the envelopes, and we wanted to do something, although we knew we couldn't do Blob in this situation. So we did have to keep it relatively official and simple. So it's a standard envelope, but on the bottom right it says important court reminder inside, and then it says open today, and the open today is in a dark red bold font. What's interesting is when we originally tested the envelopes we were using, this was actually when we were working on the Tulare study, it was the first study we used envelopes on, we had a dark like yellow orange color as the open today because we were worried the red would be seen more as spam. And we had feedback from folks that put it in red. That'll tell me that I need to open it. So we changed it to a darker red that didn't seem quite as alarming.
Got it. Yeah, one of the things that was different about this, the problem default part one study with Blob was that the message was coming from a legal services provider, not from a court. Why that should make a difference personally escapes me, but courts have been somewhat, how should I say this, obsessed, I think, with their own dignity interests. And so the idea of including a cartoon on a publication from a court, they thought, when I've talked to judges, they think that's beneath their dignity. In any case, then you also had the letter, the reminder letter example, which also appears on the Ideas 42 website. And tell me, what was the basic thought in terms of designing the letter?
We used similar principles as we use in designing the ticket or everything else we do, try to strip out all the legal language that we possibly can. So the top of the letter says court date reminder notice, very clear what this is meant to be right when you open it. And we really try to, while, you know, these communications have to be quote unquote official, to also not be scary and to be in a tone where, you know, help is available.
And then you even at the bottom, you say, any questions, we can help, which I think is, and then you say, call your lawyer or call the court at a phone number. Did you have any, I'm just curious, did you have any prior knowledge about whether, you know, if they called that number, whether someone would answer, and if so, is the person going to be nice or something, or is this just, you know, just basically saying the court say, hey, look, make sure to give them our number?
We, that's a good question. We have not done the secret shopper experience at all the courts where we work.
Got it. That's another
but
RCT.
We do. That is another study.
We can maybe be partners on that one where we do one of the old style audit studies where people call and pretend to be litigants calling. Go ahead. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Oh no, not at all. But we want to give folks as much information as we can. I mean, this even has the hours that they're open, the phone number, the website, you know, so that however people want and need to interact to get the information they can, they have those options.
Terrific. And then you did a regression discontinuity before and after study on this one in Sacramento, and it turned out to be effective in the sense of it's reducing the failure to appear rates. And then you did a similar workup for Tulare County, is that correct?
Yes, we had a similar result in Sacramento. This is the first time we've seen a study. I mentioned there was a postcard study in Nebraska. This is the first time we'd seen a mailed letter and envelope study for a criminal court. And for us, it was exciting to get the result because we want to make sure everyone gets a reminder. And so if the phone number is not available or an email is not available, that at the minimum, courts can be sending a mailed reminder to people. And they perform similar well to text messages. And so that was really important for us to see, to be able to recommend these as a viable solution. And you asked about Tulare. Tulare were for people who had traffic tickets. And there, once you get a traffic ticket, the information is sent to the court, and then the court then sends you a notice in the mail, which provides even more information that's what's on the ticket with all your different options on how you can resolve it. It reminds you of the deadline and other information.
And I'm looking at all these court forms, and I have to say I'm really missing something that's making me feel like I wasted all my time in going to law school. There's no Latin on them at all. And in the citation, excuse me, in the summons form that I mentioned that gave rise to the problem default part one, there was Latin. Do you recommend the use of Latin phrases in your court forms?
We do our best to take up anything that a person who does not have any legal knowledge would not understand. In fact, we recommend, using elementary level English and just making it as easy as possible, as much as possible. It can get tricky to try and explain the various different processes, but as much as we can, we try to simplify it for folks and help them really navigate through the system and the different options that they have available for them.
Terrific. So that's actually a great place for us to sort of begin to wind up here. What are the takeaway recommendations? If I'm a judge, if I'm a court staffer, I want to try to reduce failure to appear. I don't have a big budget. I may not have any budget at all. And it seems like without money and a lot of time and a lot of effort, I can't do anything. But that doesn't turn out to be true, it seems like to me. There are things that court systems could do that are basically close to costless or very, very low cost and certainly cost effective. So what are some takeaway lessons for folks who are in this situation?
Yes, these are both two proven solutions, and they're extremely cost effective. We know that courts and the entire system is really feeling the brunt of people missing court. It's a large problem. And what's fantastic is these forms, they can change really at no cost. It doesn't cost money to actually change the text in the form, and then they just roll out the new one either immediately or when they use up the old information that they have. And for reminders, what we see is that it can be done an extremely small cost. So we're looking at costs in, for a medium-sized jurisdiction, we're looking at costs of maybe $15,000 a year. And we compare that to the savings that courts and jurisdictions are getting from this. So I think what's really incredible is the return on investment for these interventions. We've calculated that it costs about $2,850, so $2,850 every time someone misses court.
Can we just go over that again? So let's go over that again. So it costs about $15,000 to change the way the appearance of a ticket. If my math approximately right, you need about 6 missed court dates to justify the cost.
Yes, it costs about $15,000 a year. The citation or the forms are free. The reminders are a little bit extra, and that's exactly right. I mean, we're seeing savings in the millions for many jurisdictions, and it's just I think the answer is really clear on what we need to be doing.
So, again, it doesn't completely eliminate failure to appear, but if you're looking for a low cost way to reduce or to address the problem, in part, it's hard to beat these two interventions. You might say there are three or four here. You could say a better designed court form, and then and then some form of, a mail ring reminder, a text reminder, some combination of these are among the most cost effective, the cheapest to adopt, and among the most cost effective interventions for courts that are attempting to combat administration type issues, which at least it looks like there's just very little reason not to go forward with these. Wanted to end where we began, trying to make it maybe a something somewhat somewhat philosophical question here for you. Where we began was in part why people fail to appear, and the common narrative that they do so intentionally, that they're trying to avoid the justice system, escape from it, abscond from the jurisdiction, et cetera, and suggest that that the qualitative evidence and the investigatory evidence about why people fail to appear that suggested that the story is more complicated. To me, that's suggestive, but the fact that these types of interventions work, that themselves is real proof that the standard story of people all absconding, all evading is false. In the same way that the way that we know that a dog has fleas is that if we give it something that will kill the fleas and it gets better, then we knew the dog had fleas to begin with. In other words, this is something that people call diagnosis by intervention. Does this seem like a case of diagnosis by intervention to you?
But I think we now have both the research that shows that people intend to go and the reasons they struggle, and we also have the interventions that show that if we make it easier and address some of these barriers, we can help them show up. And we've also tried to make this really easy for courts and others to do. So we have a reminders guide that we actually just published. It's a comprehensive roadmap on how to set up effective reminder programs. We have, as you mentioned on our website, examples of citations and other forms that can be redesigned, including release forms from jail to help reduce non-appearance. And this is the work we do day to day. We so far have prevented 125,000 missed court dates across the country. We talked about savings. We estimate it's about 357 million saved. And this is what we do day to day. We want to help directly. We work with courts, advocates, policymakers to bring these interventions across the country. And so if anyone would like any support or has any questions, you can reach out to us at unwarranted@ideas42.org.
And I guess one of the things, again, staggering about this is suppose your cost savings estimates are off by a factor of 90%. It's still $30 million saved, and it's still cost effective. This is what's so staggering about these things is that is they're so cheap to implement, and they're still cost effective, even if we multiplied the savings by a factor of 10. It's still worth it to do. So thank you so much for the work, Alyssa, that you and everyone at Ideas 42 is doing here. It is a model for courts generally for access to justice advocates. My only concern is that people will listen to this and say that, oh, all access to justice promoting reforms are this easy and this cheap to implement. And I will just have to warn our listeners that there are some that are quite worthwhile doing, but that are actually much, much harder. And we may not know all that we need to know about those yet, but it's unlikely to be this easy. That said, the fact then that this one is easy and extremely cost effective suggests there's no excuse for people who aren't moving in this direction. So again, thank you so much, Alyssa. Any final thoughts for us?
Thanks for highlighting this important issue. Like I mentioned before, we think it's a hidden crisis and it's something that is really solvable, at least a good part of it, if we're doing this work. So we're just really thrilled that you are elevating this and sharing it so we can help make the changes that are needed.
Terrific. And we hope you'll join us again at some point with the Proof Over Precedent podcast. And again, thanks so much for your time. Take care.
Thank you, Jim.
Proof Over Precedent is a production of the Access to Justice Lab at Harvard Law School. Views expressed in student podcasts are not necessarily those of the A to J Lab. Thanks for listening. If we piqued your interest, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Even better, leave us a rating or share an episode with a friend or on social media. Here's a sneak preview of what we'll bring you next week.
Some of the research shows that failure to appear rates actually decreased post-COVID when Zoom popped up as an option. So just to provide some of the data, there was a 60% decrease in failure to appear rates in the municipal county court in Alvin, Texas. In areas of North Dakota, New Jersey, and Michigan, appearance rates skyrocketed to above 99% from 80, 80, and 89.3% respectively. There were decreases by 6% in failure to appear in Buckeye County, Arizona, and there were overall decreases in Jefferson County, Alabama, and Lincoln County, Washington.